Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion on politics, human rights, and the environment. I'm Dori Smith. We turn once again to the 2nd District Congressional race in Connecticut, where Democrat Joe Courtney has a 6-point lead over incumbent Republican Rob Simmons. We look at debate one, interview the candidates, and question Rob Simmons about CIA wrongdoing uncovered during the 1970s by the Church and Pike committees. He brought the investigations up, but in our interview, he called their massive reports hogwash. And they were also talking about the reading of the mail of the American people.
It's hogwash.
But these facts were admitted, right?
One of those reports had to do with the CIA's domestic spying, including the opening of 250,000 pieces of first-class mail, which is a direct violation of federal legislation, a criminal act.
Politics professor Christopher H. Pyle joins us to comment on the interview that I did with Rob Simmons. The voice you're about to hear is the voice of former President George H.W. Bush.
You have to deal sometimes with bad guys. Gentlemen do read other people's mail. And so it's a tough business, but I come back to where I started. Rob understood this. He lived it. And now he brings that expertise that very, very few members of Congress have to fighting the battle against terror.
In our last program, we heard Rob Simmons and former President George H.W. Bush at a Simmons fundraising breakfast at the plush Water's Edge Resort and Spa in Westbrook, Connecticut, September 6th. Democrat Joe Courtney stood on the street outside of that resort with supporters from several unions, including AFSCME, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. They've endorsed Courtney, as have several other major unions. Talk about the difference between the crowd out here and the one inside.
Well, these are the people that are feeling the Bush economy, which the census data that came out last week demonstrated median family income has not increased at all over the last 5 years. Poverty rates are going up. The number of uninsured is now 47.6 million people in this country, up about 4 or 5 million since Bush and Simmons took office. These folks here feel that pressure on working families every day with their membership, and they understand that Rob Simmons and the Bush administration are headed in the wrong direction, refusing to raise the minimum wage, doing nothing to create trade agreements that protect good jobs in the state in this country, and allowing the health care problem to just completely fester with no hope in sight for families that, again, have inadequate coverage. So in that particular area, which is the effect of the Bush agenda on working families, the choice between my candidacy and Rob Simmons could not be clearer.
Talk to me about some of the business and industry concerns that you will have should you be elected, and perhaps some of the new directions you might take Connecticut in.
Well, first of all, the biggest concern I think business has is the outrageous cost of energy that in a place like New England is destroying jobs. We had a press conference 2 weeks ago up in Franklin where a plant that employed 600 people closed its doors completely due to the fact that their energy costs went from $2.5 million 2 years ago to $5 million this past year, and they literally shut down the entire facility. If we don't go in a new direction in terms of breaking our dependence on fossil fuel, this part of the country has got a very grim future. We should be investing in alternative energy technologies like biodiesel, which is what this plant owner is now trying to convert his facility into, but it is getting no help from the federal government in terms of tax policy or assistance. If we don't invest in more conservation alternative energy sources, New England in the Northeast is really going to struggle. And manufacturers particularly feel that pressure. And that's one of the many reasons, again, why there's such a bright line choice in this fall's election about what which direction this country is going to be headed. And energy policy is a big piece of that.
I noticed that the Republican candidate running against Ned Lamont was there this morning.
Yep.
And there's a division here that is not being discussed very clearly in the press. I mean, there's discussion about the polls right now, but not about the parties and where the voters stand with the parties. Just talk about that for a moment, please.
Well, I certainly think in the case of the House races, people do understand that there is a very big decision facing Connecticut voters this fall, because control of Congress will be decided to a large degree about what happens in these three contested races, the 5th District, the 4th District, and the 2nd District. As the New York Times said, if those districts move, if they switch hands, the earth moves in terms of the direction of Congress. If they don't, then the Bush agenda is going to stay firmly in place. And the whole world is going to be watching the state of Connecticut on election night to see what choice the people of Connecticut make.
Joe Courtney, thanks so much.
We've got a good union supporter here, too, who can talk a little bit if you'd like.
Hi. What union are you with?
AFSCME.
And tell me why AFSCME is supporting Joe Courtney in the 2nd District.
Because Joe Courtney believes in all the values that our members hold true. We need somebody who's looking for universal health care, somebody who's interested in jobs, growth in this state, somebody who cares about the people, and we're not finding this with the Bush administration at all or with the Rell administration.
Comment, if you would, please, on some of the international questions, security, the funding for the war in Iraq, some of the issues pressing on the average worker that they may feel powerless to do anything to change.
I think the major issue is the money that is being siphoned from this United States, this state, and not paying for the things that we need here at home is just, I mean, it's a sin. We have families right here in our state that have no health insurance. They have all kinds of issues with No Child Left Behind, and we're not funding any of these mandates, but we're sending, you know, $2.5 billion a day to Iraq, and it doesn't make sense.
Carol Senske is with AFSCME. We turn now to the Simmons-Courtney debate held on September 18th at New London's Guard Theater, where the crowd was energized as they waited for the candidates. An animated Joe Courtney took on the prescription drug industry as he spoke about how to reduce prescription drug costs for seniors. Rob Simmons argued for the business side, saying he supports association health plans. Courtney then argued that association plans would simply override state-mandated programs.
I started a petition drive in this district to go to Congress and say, push back the enrollment period. For God's sake, show some decency for people who are struggling with trying to make life and death decisions about what's the right health care plans for them. And Rob Simmons refused to sign that bill to push back the enrollment period and to push back the penalties. Disgraceful. We can do better as a nation to treat our seniors and people with disabilities. And I can tell you something, to all those seniors who didn't sign up for this program, you got nothing to worry about. Because when I go to Congress with a new majority, we're going to fix this program and do it the right way.
The key question is, what kind of a national health care plan or national health insurance plan are we going to have? Is it going to be a government-sponsored, government-provided, government-run plan that the government will then operate with tax increases on all the citizens in this country? Is it going to be that kind of a plan, or is it going to be more of a public-private partnership where we bring in the creativity of the American medical profession? And I can tell you, I get sick and tired of hearing how health care is such a problem in this country when we have the best health care in the world, when people come to this country for health care. Access is a problem, and paying for it is the problem. So I tend to prefer what I call public-private approaches, association health plans, so that your small business can associate with other small businesses, not just here in Connecticut, but around New England, to aggregate and pool your people to get the benefit of leverage and bargaining.
The association health plans, which Rob talks about, what they will do is wipe out all mandates that exist at the state level. It's an override of state laws that have been built up for year in and year out. I know there's state legislators here, like I think Ken Prisby and Andrea Stillman, who worked hard to get some of the basic elements of health care built into Connecticut state law. They would be wiped out with the stroke of George Bush's pen.
When the issue of Social Security was raised, The debate began to reflect the hallmark differences between Republican and Democratic outlooks. Again, Rob Simmons argued more for the business side and private accounts, while Joe Courtney argued more for government investment in making sure all Americans have affordable health care and more certainty about Social Security retirement incomes. Veteran political reporter Mark Davis of WTIC in Connecticut asked about changing the withholding levels.
The wage base now, I think, you know, the cap is $90,400, something like that. And we pay 6.25%, and our employer pays 6.25%. Don't you think that a more equitable way to try to solve this would be to do what the Reagan Commission did 25 years ago, and that is tax more wages than just $90,400? Because people who make $2 million a year only pay on that first $90,400 on Social Security. Don't you think that would be a more equitable way to try to deal with the problem? Or do you think the privatization plan would work?
I oppose privatizing Social Security. I've always opposed privatizing Social Security, and I continue to oppose privatizing Social Security. And ever since I first ran, I have described the system that I have in mind, which actually replicates one of the three options listed in the Moynihan proposal, which is that Social Security should be kept as the foundation or the basis of retirement security for all Americans now and into the future, but that a separate category of investments, tax sheltered, should be operated as an add-on to the system, a checkoff to the system, where individuals can choose to set aside a certain amount of their discretionary income, not tax, not the tax revenue, but their discretionary income for savings.
$90,400, should that go up?
There again, I think that's a very important thing to consider, absolutely.
Because it sounds like a tax increase and you don't want to say yes.
Well, if it's Social Security, you get it back, right?
Right.
The president did, in fact, give an interview in the Wall Street Journal a week ago Saturday where he said if there was a Republican majority back in office January 07, first order of business is going to be Social Security private accounts. Congressman McCreary from Louisiana, who's slated to take over the House Ways and Means Committee, has said exactly the same thing. And I think people really need to understand as we go into the final 50 days of this election that George Bush's agenda, his name may not be on the ballot, but his agenda is on the ballot. And this guy is coming back at this system one more time. Rob Simmons has had more positions on Social Security than a weather vane in a Northeaster in eastern Connecticut. He took money from the Club for Economic Growth in 2000, whose sole reason for being is to privatize Social Security. He said that the president, after the president's speech a year ago last January, that private accounts have to be part of the solution. But to me, actually, the most disturbing comment that he made was a comment he made to the Washington Post when they asked him about Social Security. He said, "When does it go broke? 2042? I'll be dead by then." Well, you know what? My kids are not going to be dead by then.
There are issues of class and race behind a Connecticut lawsuit over the unfunded mandate No Child Left Behind. Connecticut Attorney General Richard Blumenthal and other lawmakers have taken on the Bush administration over issues like testing and funding. Joe Courtney adamantly agrees with the lawsuit. Rob Simmons is opposed to it.
This year, just as the kids were going back to school, the state of Connecticut lost $8 million in Title I, the primary funding mechanism for underperforming schools under No Child Left Behind, $2 million in eastern Connecticut. We did press conferences.
In the time that that legislation has been in place, the funding to Connecticut, the dollars that have come to us, have grown to from $206 million a year to $314 million a year. The special ed dollars have increased by over 50%. So there has been substantial funding under No Child Left Behind. But the real question is, why has the funding not reached the local municipalities? Why has it not reached our school systems? I believe that if we look carefully, we will find that some of those dollars have been diverted to other purposes. And that's something that I think we need to take a very close look at.
We're still with the Courtney-Simmons debate held in New London September 18th. It was sponsored by the New London Day and the paper's editorial page editor Morgan McGinley asked if there were individuals in U.S. custody where the Geneva Conventions would not apply.
We need a new kind of law for a new kind of war. When I went to Guantanamo Bay a year ago to see what the conditions were for the detainees, I was told by one of the soldiers that the hardest thing they have to do is figure out how to provide fair and equitable and just treatment for a category of people who don't fit within the traditional criminal justice system or within the traditional prisoner of war system.
Since the moderator allowed Rob Simmons to go overtime, Joe Courtney was not allowed to answer as the debate ended on a sour note from Simmons.
And if Joe goes to Congress next year, do you think the Bush administration is going to help him with anything?
I support John McCain's proposal before the Senate Armed Services Committee. As he put it very eloquently, the president's plan would jeopardize our men and women in uniform, and his proposal, I think, protected them. And unfortunately, Rob voted with the president and the House Armed Services Committee this last week, which, again, demonstrates that for all of his claims for independence, he followed his leadership and was a rubber stamp for George Bush on one of the most critical constitutional issues of the day.
Rob Simmons and Joe Courtney are squaring off for the second time with the lead issue, the war in Iraq. Courtney supports a deadline for troop withdrawal. Simmons does not.
Senator Spector was absolutely right. Ethno-sectarian violence is just a fancy term for a civil war. That's what we're seeing happen right now. It does not have to be, however, a complete failed state, which will be a new nest for terrorists that would threaten this country. What it does take, though, is a change in policy in Washington to recognize the reality of what exactly is happening in Iraq today. And there are good, thoughtful people in Washington that have been trying for the last 3.5 years to get this administration, led by Donald Rumsfeld, to listen to other voices about different choices that we can make.
I spoke with Rob Simmons right after the debate ended.
I was at your fundraising breakfast on the 6th of September.
Yes.
And you and the former president discussed the Church and Pike committees.
Yes.
And you were kind of negative about the results, and you talked about the fact that they had demoralized the CIA.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Just comment on the similarity between what's going on Capitol Hill right now, as the president is under criticism from his own party and from leading Democrats about torture, assassination,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
and the reading of Americans' mail. A lot of similarities there.
Well, the Church and Pike committees investigated the intelligence community, but we all know that Senator Frank Church was actually running for president. And so he used the investigation to promote himself publicly, to create a high profile for himself, and I felt that he was very unfair in some of the allegations that he made against the intelligence community. The intelligence community was never a rogue elephant. The intelligence community was always tightly controlled by presidential power, whether it was President Eisenhower or Truman or Kennedy. So to say it was a rogue elephant was just totally and completely unfair. All of the hype about the dart gun was never used on anybody at any time ever. So there were a lot of aspects to those investigations that I felt were hyped. And I felt as a person on the front line in a foreign country undercover trying to collect information for my leadership, for me to be characterized the way we were characterized during those committee hearings, I felt was unfair. I'm a Vietnam veteran, but that doesn't mean I'm Lieutenant Kelly.
But they were talking about 25,000 dead under the Phoenix program, assassination by computerized system.
No.
And they were also talking about the reading of the mail of the American people.
It's hogwash.
But these facts were admitted.
No,
right?
They're not.
Right? They
no.
were. If you read
no.
the testimony, they admitted this.
I served for 3.5 years in Vietnam, and I think, there was a lot of propaganda, a lot of disinformation that was put out about the agency's various programs. Bill Colby was in charge of the Phoenix program. He went on to become the director of Central Intelligence. He was an honest and decent man. He would not engage in those activities.
So you're saying Phoenix didn't happen?
Yes, sir.
In an upcoming Talk Nation Radio special, we'll be turning to journalist and author Douglas Valentine to talk about a role he says Rob Simmons played in the program. Doug Valentine is author of the book The Phoenix Program, and you can find his articles on the subject in Counterpunch. Professor Christopher H. Pyle specializes in constitutional law, civil liberties, rights of privacy, and U.S. politics. He teaches at Mount Holyoke College in Massachusetts. He served on Senator Frank Church's committee investigating CIA abuses and criminal activities during the 1970s. I asked him to comment on the congressman's denial that the CIA read the mail of U.S. citizens, and also on Simmons' vote for President Bush's bill on the Geneva Conventions.
Rob is certainly right that Church was running for president, and he did a few theatrical things like displaying a dart gun and calling the CIA a rogue elephant. But when the dust settled and the politicking was over, we had reports from a staff of 130 people on the Church Committee, and I was a member of that staff, that were very carefully documented, extensively researched. One of those reports had to do with the CIA's domestic spying, including the opening of 250,000 pieces of first-class mail, which is a direct violation of federal legislation, the Criminal Act. They had four programs doing that, and it was a dragnet surveillance and pulled in all sorts of people who should never have been monitored by the CIA. And the CIA admitted that and backed down. So Rob may have been out of the country and didn't follow all this, but we had extensive evidence of domestic activity by the CIA in violation of its charter, and that was properly rebuked.
Talk about the behavior of the CIA in Indochina in general, what you know about how there were abuses committed and what kinds of things were documented under Church and Pike hearings.
I think the important thing for Americans to understand is not to focus on what happens in military units and paramilitary units during the war in Vietnam, but to understand that from the 1950s, the CIA had an extensive program of research and development in the area of torture, and particularly torture that leaves no scars. And they learned this from the North Koreans. They learned it from the Soviet KGB. They had behavioral scientists studying this at Cornell and other places. And they produced manuals for the torture of people, including a manual in the 1960s, which then morphed into another manual that was used in the 1980s in Latin America. And these call for many of the practices that turned up in Afghanistan and Iraq today. So the CIA is deep into research into how you interrogate people under torture without leaving scars, without leaving marks that can then be used as evidence of criminal activity on the part of the CIA. But there's no question that this stuff violates the Geneva Conventions. It violates the War Crimes Act of 1996. It violates the Convention Against Torture. It violates domestic criminal law. And the CIA has been deeply involved in that. And there's no way that any rational person who looked at the evidence could say otherwise. This is not hogwash. And I'm concerned because Simmons, as a member of the Armed Services Committee, voted on behalf of the president's bill that would essentially repeal or abrogate the Geneva Conventions. He would also essentially immunize the CIA and the president and the president's staff who authorized this abuse and torture in Iraq, Afghanistan, and Guantanamo. He would give them a license to torture people, and that, I think, is outrageous.
Now, the aim of the committees in the 1970s was to change these practices. And just talk about the problem of oversight and then reform and what didn't happen and what kinds of things you see as a possible consequence, including perhaps Abu Ghraib.
Going back to the 70s, Rob is right. The CIA was not a rogue elephant. On the other hand, it was not closely supervised by presidents either. It did what the presidents wanted done, but without informing the presidents of the details. Presidents, like any politician, want to preserve plausible denial. And President Nixon and President Johnson were no different. They wanted to preserve plausible denial. But the CIA did these operations. That can't be denied. That's part of the unimpeachable historical record.
General Peter Pace argued that 99% of U.S. forces operating in Iraq were patriotic, good soldiers, and would never do such
patriotism
a thing.
Patriotism has nothing to do with it.
Well, I think the argument, though, is their hands were clean of any atrocities.
I don't know how he knows that.
Well, let me ask you about the tone of that language, though, because in a way it's very similar to what Simmons has reported about what he knows of Indochina, having been there for the CIA. Both of these guys are basically arguing for the dignity, morality, family values of the CIA or the U.S. military operating in both Iraq and historically in Indochina.
We now have extensive evidence of torture and the abuse of prisoners in a variety of military units all over Afghanistan and Iraq and at Guantanamo. The military has conducted prosecutions, it's reprimanded scores and scores of people. The evidence is there. And to say that the soldiers are all good people is an overstatement. To say that they're all bad people is a terrible overstatement. But the fact is that in wartime, people do a lot of things they would not do as civilians. They are trained to make snap judgments. They're trained to hate the enemy. And that means they need tremendous discipline or they are likely to commit war crimes. This is true of any army for any country. And there is nothing particularly more moral about American soldiers and soldiers of any other country. They are human beings under the stress of warfare. They need to have discipline. They need to be restrained. The very idea of having laws of war and expecting that soldiers are going to act morally under all circumstances of stress is an unnatural idea. It only works if the leadership is strong in insisting that our soldiers are to be different from other soldiers, that they are held to a higher standard. That did not happen in the confusion of Vietnam, and it did not happen in Iraq. And it did not happen in Iraq because the administration from the highest level was encouraging forms of interrogation that amounted to torture and cruelty and inhumanity. And these dogs of war were unleashed upon a civilian population. And the results were tragic. But that's to be expected. The other part of it is when you unleash them in interrogations, you unleash them in incarceration. And much of the torture in Iraq is the abuse of people for the fun of it, for entertainment. The vast majority of it, including Abu Ghraib, was not done in the interrogation rooms. It was not done to make people safer. It was not done to get actionable intelligence. It was done to justify detentions.
Is there anything about the Geneva Conventions that indicates that those who wrote them agreed that there would be variations depending on the kind of people that were dealt with in war zones?
No, they were written precisely to avoid those distinctions. Those are the distinctions that the Nazis had made. The Nazis had said that if American commandos dropped into Norway or behind German lines, they were not to be given the protections of the Geneva Conventions. We prosecuted them for that. They said that they could not give Russian soldiers the protections of the Geneva Conventions because the Russians represented Bolshevik terrorism. That was the exact word that the Germans used. And we said, no, Russian soldiers were entitled to the protections of the Geneva Conventions. The Germans did give American soldiers the protections of the Geneva Conventions, by and large. I had a relative who was in a German POW camp. The Americans got that as prisoners of the Germans because Germans knew that hundreds of thousands of their people had been captured by the Americans. In fact, when the war ended, the fact that the Americans treated German prisoners so decently meant that the Germans all fled to the American lines instead of going to the Russian lines where they would have been slaughtered because they had killed the vast majority of Russian prisoners in their detention camps. So there were good reasons to have Geneva Conventions that protect everybody, to create reciprocity, to protect our own soldiers, and to reduce the indiscriminate, foolish, unnecessary carnage of warfare.
Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Christopher H. Pyle's articles have appeared in The Nation, The New York Times, The Washington Post, Wall Street Journal, and many other publications. His articles on military surveillance of civilian politics won the Polk and Hillman Awards for investigative journalism. For Talk Nation Radio, I'm Dori Smith. This program is produced in the studios of WHUS Radio in Storrs, Connecticut, at the University of Connecticut. WHUS.org to listen live, Wednesdays at 5 p.m., TalkNationRadio.org, and TalkNation.org for transcripts and discussion. Our music is by Fritz Heed.